Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, if you plan to head to the grocery store today, you're probably going to find bacon priced at around $7 a pound, I'm thinking. And we're going to talk about rising meat prices with Jeff Sindelar. Jeff's a meat specialist, meat scientist for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Great to have him with us. And certainly looking forward to hearing from you about these prices. Maybe you work in the meat industry, or maybe you work in an industry that's affected by higher meat prices. I hope you'll join in. What's supply and demand been like throughout the pandemic for you? You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jeff Sindelar, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, good morning. Thank you, Larry. I'm happy to be part of the program and join the conversation today.
Well, I'll tell you what, all meat prices seem to be up according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. How high are those prices?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I am not an ag economist, but they are significantly higher than they used to be, right? Seeing prices, you know, on average, you know, 25, 30, in some cases 50% where they were from a couple of years ago is not uncommon. And unfortunately, I'm not sure if we're going to see a whole lot of solace or very much reprise from that for a little while now.
Well, I'm sure people are wondering, why the heck is meat so expensive? What's your take on it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's as I've told others, it's kind of the million-dollar question, and there's a very simple way to answer that, and there's a very complicated way. The simple way is it's the very basics of supply and demand. Right now, there is a tremendous supply, a very strong supply for meat, regardless of species, beef, pork, lamb, poultry, and so forth. And there's a relatively low supply
now. A high demand, low supply.
Yeah, some definitely might argue, especially if you are a animal producer trying to find a place to take your animals, that may not be the case. But you know, it becomes a little more complicated beyond that simple response. And we have to add other factors which drive that very simple law of supply and demand, such as pressures for exports. Right now, the export markets, although they're constantly fluctuating, they're booming. More people outside the U.S. want to purchase U.S. products, meat products, and that same trend is happening domestically. Lots more people are wanting to buy more product and are willing to pay more money for those products, which all drives the cost of meat that we see on a daily basis in supermarkets.
Well, on the producer side, if there's no place to sell your product or to put your product to the meatpacking plant, you got to sit there and still feed those animals. So the cost on this, what I'm saying is Wisconsin producers aren't really benefiting from these high prices.
I would absolutely concur with that, and I sympathize with the producers across the state of Wisconsin, as well as across the country, that are in those situations. Right now, we're continually to be in this very strange and awkward time where the supply of animals is relatively high, the demand for the meat coming from processors, packers, and so forth is high and continually, on average, grows, and the availability for places to harvest those animals is continually on a downward trend, and there's lots of reasons that is driving those that phenomenon.
Yeah, unfortunately, with Dave and Toma, let's give Dave and Toma a chance to join in. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I've got to take issue with those numbers, though. You know, they're talking about a 16% increase. Well, for those of us that buy groceries, which is most of us, you know, the prices are up considerably more than 16%. I'd say between 25 and 50%. And it's like last year, the government was telling us inflation was 7%. Well, wages in my area have gone up at least 50% in the last year. People aren't going to give those up. And I thought, well, those people in Washington are stupid. But then come about June last year, I realized they're not stupid people. They don't put stupid people in those positions. The government's been lying to us, and that's how I feel about all these numbers.
Yeah. Well, comment on that, Jeff.
Well, numbers are definitely going up, and in most cases for all of us, including myself, in the wrong direction. And right, we are seeing meat industry specific, right? There are not enough people to do the jobs. The meat industry is, an easy way to think about it is spending 7 days to do 5 days of work, right? And that's driven by just not enough bodies, not enough people, not enough workers to do the work. In response to that, the meat industry, small, medium, and large size establishments are increasing their salaries, right? Their wages, increasing benefits, doing some incentives to work, right? Start work as well as incentives to, continue working. And that model, that mechanism isn't quite working really well. So as a result, the cost to, right, harvest animals and produce meat is still high. And I think we would all agree too high, which is trickling down to very high retail store prices.
Mm. You know, thanks, Dave, for calling. Jim in River Falls may have a slightly different look at this. Let's go there. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for the program. Yeah, my thought is that, you know, we've artificially suppressed the cost of meats, and the USDA, you know, they put a lot of money into egg programs to artificially lower the price of corn and soybean production to supply for feed animals in these big corporate farms. And the environment and the health of the global ecosystems are put at jeopardy because we should be paying more for meat. We should be eating less meat to help the global environment, really, and reduce greenhouse gas.
Well, Jim, thanks for calling. Jeff, a comment.
Yeah, those are really great points, interesting points, and I appreciate you making them. So, first off, I think that there maybe is some overinflation that occurs because, you know, the U.S. is industrially speaking, across the board, really good at what we do. And that is absolutely true for meat processing, right? The big packers, right, the ones that are always mentioned in the news.
Is industrially speaking, across the board, really good at what we do. And that is absolutely true for meat processing, right? The big packers, right? The ones that are always mentioned in the news is industrially speaking.
Ah, we lost Jeff. I tell you what, we'll get him back. Jeff Sindelar, is our guest. He's a professor and extension meat scientist at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He actually works out of the Department of Meat Science and Animal Biologics Discovery. That's the name of the department. We'll get him back here in just a second, but probably a good time to remind you that Courtney Everett was our producer, or is our producer today, and Trina LaSousa is our engineer, and I'm Larry Mueller, and you, my friends, are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at high meat prices on the program right now with our guest, Jeff Sindelar, professor and extension meat scientist with UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Great to have him with us. And certainly, if you want to join in, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Jeff's back. Sorry, we lost you there for a minute, Jeff, but you were commenting on something. Oh, it had to do with the maybe prices being too low for meat over time, and we should be paying more.
Yeah, thank you, and sorry I dropped off. So, as I mentioned earlier, I think these are really, really excellent points. And in the U.S. As well as Wisconsin, industrially speaking, we do a really great job of being very efficient, and the meat industry is absolutely true for doing that. And often, you know, the big four meat packers kind of get, you know, blamed for, you know, monopolizing and the market and so forth. And although, you know, that could be arguably true, right, they also result in very high production of meat poultry products. They're very efficient at it. And when that system, when that model is working, it results in it results in keeping meat prices down. When we get in these pandemic situations where that model doesn't work quite so well, and then things kind of get out of whack, and that definitely is part of what I believe the cause of why we're seeing increased meat prices.
And you know, here we are talking about meat prices in the grocery store, but this has got to have a ripple effect on pizza prices that you go when or restaurants in terms of, you know, if you're selling steak in a restaurant or something with bacon on it, you almost have to raise your prices, don't you?
Absolutely. I laugh a little bit because I think of years ago, back when a big name brand pizza company, National Pizza Company, would advertise their pepperoni pizzas being on sale, and how that action would create this crazy response where the meat industry in the U.S. could not produce enough pepperoni to supply those pizza restaurants. And so, right, even though we have a pretty stable market in the U.S., it can be pretty volatile pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, let's take another call. Jane in Manitowish Waters. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning, Larry and guest. Just something for your consideration, once again, on the consumer side. This is something I've heard commented on, but would like to hear what you think. You know, there's an opportunity for profiteering at the folks who sell, you know, the markets, the supermarkets, what have you, to raise prices higher than they need to because, you know, there's short supply. So, I'd get your opinion on that.
Yeah, thanks, Jane.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, or I'm sorry, excellent point, excellent comment. You know, the grocery stores and supermarkets, as hopefully most of us know, work on pretty thin margins. I mean, a couple percent profit is really what supermarkets shoot for, and you know, there's definitely some flexibility, some range in different types of products, right? Produce and meat and canned goods and prepared foods and so forth. But at the end of the day, those supermarkets, right, those grocery stores, they have to maintain a little bit of profit to stay in the green. And as a result, you know, they are the ones that predominantly are setting the prices for meat products, so that they can, right, balance out their portfolio of all the different foods that they're selling so that they can stay profitable. But opportunities for alternative methods of merchandising are definitely excellent ideas.
You know, when you look at those meat prices, and I took a look at bacon, you know, and here it is, $7 bucks a pound or whatever, and it seems like a higher jump than some of the other meat products. To me, is that the case, and why is that the case?
Yeah, so right now, I would say that probably is the case. Bacon's been hot for years, high in demand for years. And, you know, 5-7 years ago, the U.S. and Wisconsin were not producing enough hogs to supply the bellies to make the bacon. And now, you know, you add the, you know, current pandemic and the resulting increased consumer demands and export and driving feed costs for raising those animals and the challenge of the labor and transportation. And, you know, that demand is just magnified, right?
Yeah.
So we're seeing, I believe, this result of demand that existed before, but like on steroids, right? And so because of it, it's just driving the cost from production all the way to what the consumers are seeing and having to pay for in grocery stores.
Yeah. Let's go to Betty in Dodgeville. Betty, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. Thanks. Great show. I don't know, did you hear my if or whatever?
No, I didn't hear.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I grew up on a farm, I had meat for free. I had milk for free other than just getting it ourselves. And I think we're forgetting to mention the farmers in this whole situation. You have not once mentioned them. And if you buy local, stay local, you'll get your meat and all that at a reasonable price. But all the middleman is taking it all.
Well, we did talk about the farmers a bit, Betty. You may have missed that. But Jeff, a comment on that.
Yeah, that's right. So appreciate the comment. I grew up on a farm too, and I smiled, right? Cause
I did too.
we had free meat too, lots and lots of pork. We raised lots of hogs back in the day when a big population was different than what a big hog herd or big population is today. But it's really a struggle. You know, my family's still in farming, still in agriculture, and I look at the input costs for farming. I look at, how that trickles into feeding livestock. And, not only are farmers battling, getting a good price for their animals at the market, right? They're battling the increased cost to feed those animals and purchase those animals, right? And, all those input costs, as well as the labor to take care of them, right? And that's all, exaggerated by the increased demand from domestic consumers, the increased demand internationally, and right. I think it's probably important to note that although some might argue, why are we exporting meat, right? When that's potentially causing meat prices to be increased in the U.S. Well, we export meat to help stabilize the markets when that demand isn't quite so high, right? And that allows farmers and producers to hopefully stay in business so that those, live prices really don't drop too horribly low.
You know, Pat in Milwaukee has something that relates right to this. Let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's really interesting, really important in so many moving parts, right?
Yeah.
I'm 60 and scarcity of water, I heard of that, I believe it, and it's coming, it's being more critical. So we're growing wheat with all of our water and our Aguilera water tables are disappearing. We're growing the wheat cheaply. Sometimes it's pretty well subsidized. We're farming the cows in herds of 10,000 or whatever, crazy numbers. And then the foreign countries that don't have water, like Saudi Arabia, they're like buying our meat at this. They're not, destroying or having to do some crazy expensive way to make water. They buy our discount meat, and we're all struggling. The farmers are individuals. They don't unionize. So they're not up for this new world challenge of this value they have. So, let the market do its place. But I think our government and the farmers have to start seeing this like theft, and I'm not, but this like abuse of foreign, purchases upping the price. And yeah, I could go on, but I've had enough coffee, and you guys have a lot to get to.
All right, Pat.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you. Jeff, a comment.
Yeah, so I'll be careful on this one because I don't want to get too far one way or another. But definitely, there is a balance that needs to maintain, and it's probably the ever-looting, impossible goal of ever hitting that balance. But definitely, there are countries outside the U.S. that are getting a pretty good deal, right? We do all the work. We are dealing with, our natural resources, right? Both taking from it as well as trying to replenish it because of the production of food, right? Other countries don't have to do that. They just have to, right, pay the bill and, per se, and go on. And I think, definitely moving forward now and moving forward, we need to recognize the importance and value of the Wisconsin farmer, the Wisconsin producer, the Wisconsin rancher, right? And what that means, right? Living off the land, providing safe, wholesome, nutritious food products, in this case, meat products. And what does that really mean for the state of Wisconsin, as well as those consumers here and across, outside the U.S.
And Pat also had commented about, should there be a surcharge, for example, on meats that go to some of those other countries, or any country, I guess, other than the U.S., that could be applied to the farmer side of it.
Yeah, great, great question. So we have limitations for what we can export from the U.S. And to what country. But by and large, we can export fresh meats, right, and things that are further processed, such as hot dogs, hams, bacon, so forth, we're not able to export. The U.S. meat companies sometimes work through this by building plants in other countries so that they can produce those products and sell those products. But the tariffs topic is, you know, the tax or the surcharge is the really good one. And, you know, that gets into international trade policy. And there are all kinds of crazy tariffs and negotiations and, right, do this and get this. And we put a tariff on these goods if you put a tariff on these goods. And things are eased because of different political, right, international conversations. And but definitely a good thought and a good point to discuss.
Ron in La Crosse, let's go to you now. Hi, Ron. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm wondering how the restrictions on immigration have impacted the industry, being as how most of the folks working in the meatpacking industry, butchering and such, are immigrants, as well as on dairies. Yeah. Most of the people actually doing the milking and working the farms on dairies are also immigrant laborers. And also, like, for instance, in China, China owns most of or a big chunk of the pork production in the U.S., like Smithfield Foods is owned by WH Group out of China. How is that impacting as well if Brazilian meat producers own a lot of the beef production? Can you speak to that as far as how that's influencing the industry? Thanks.
Thanks, Ron. What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, those are really, really great questions, Ron. So the first one, impact on immigration. So the meat industry in the state of Wisconsin and in the U.S., right, was really based on people immigrating, right, from other countries, right? So in Wisconsin, for example, we had a lot of European immigrants, as well as, you know, some immigrants from other parts of the world when Wisconsin was founded, right? That's They came here. They wanted to live here. Some of them had certain skills and trades. Some of them were meat processors. And voila, lo and behold, the meat industry, right, a couple hundred years later, here's the great state of Wisconsin. The meat industry has remained viable over the years because of immigration, and it's kind of gone through waves of immigration. And immigrants have been extremely important, regardless of what your position is on immigration, to help make sure that those big companies can run very, very efficiently, right? Have enough people to work in them, and then pay them a wage which is, right, suitable and acceptable for those workers. Lots of things have changed, right, in the past 10, 15, 20 years with immigration, with different laws and you know, crackdowns and border stuff and all types of things. And we've seen a reduction in the, you know, number of immigrants that are working these same companies, same plants. And that's definitely been a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Matt from Madison sent an email. He says meat should be more a treat than a staple. Maybe that's what meat should cost, considering its toll on the environment. So a comment there from Matt. Kim from Madison sent us an email. She says industrial meat is destructive through the supply chain, including cutting down tropical forests. It's been called lungs of the world. She says cheap meat is very expensive to our health and environment. If she eats meat, she buys pastured animals who create soil instead of ruin it. What are your thoughts on industrial meat?
Yeah, that's a great, great, great question, great topic. So there's absolutely no question that, you know, raising of livestock for meat has impact on the environment. However, you know, living as a human being has an impact on the environment as well. So, right, you could go into have a great discussion about which has more impact and how's it different and so forth and why. However, you know, meat is an important component of a healthy, balanced diet, you know, right? the protein is something that is important, right, for sustaining life. And for sure, right, there's other options for protein, not non-meat protein, but, right, to feed the masses, right, raise our children, all those things. It'd be really hard to do today without having meat as a significant component of the state as well as the world. Now, where that meat comes from, right? So the comment about pasture-raised meat, that is another really unique point to bring up, because, you know, there's lots of different ways, lots of different production styles, right? So there's, you know, things like grass-fed, grass-finished, you know, organic, natural, you know, no grain ever fed, antibiotic-free, you know, all these different production approaches, and you know, moving away from protein being very important and sustainable for a population, how that meat was raised, the production styles, right, can have some significant impact on things like environmental concerns and sustainability. But by and large, right, if you look at the averages, it's probably not as significant as just the industry trying to do the best and what they can and do things, you know, in a sustainable and in an efficient approach as reasonably possible.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned organic, and I just had, as an aside, I just saw a report this morning that Wisconsin has the sixth most organic farmland in the U.S. We have about 251,000 acres, which is quite a bit, but in the large scheme of agriculture across our state, it's probably not a huge percentage, but a significant one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Eric in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was curious what your perspective was on the possibilities, both short-term and long-term, of that price gap between meat and the non-meat alternatives. As that closes, what would you expect to see in terms of that industry either growing in terms of, you know, more people reaching out to have some of that alternative meat option versus, you know, if they've always been buying just real meat? I'll take a question off here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. Great points. Great questions. So right now, right, so kind of out in the marketplace, there are, you know, the meat as an option, and then there's some non-meat alternatives. And non-meat alternatives have been around for quite some time, right? Things made from soy or peas or other protein sources. Today's versions are just much more advanced technologically, so they perform much, much more closer to meat in terms of flavor, taste, texture, right? All of those important things. Those meat alternatives, you know, the price as well as availability is really driven by consumer demand, right? Right now, the margin, the difference between meat and non-meat is fairly significant. However, the production and the availability of those non-meat options is fairly small, right? If consumers want more of it, the companies that are making these products will increase their capacities, right? Increasing the capacities will likely increase some efficiencies, and that those efficiencies, the cost savings from those efficiencies will likely trickle back down to the consumer. It's no different than the model that's followed by the big four packers, right? Figure out how to do something very efficiently, right? Industrialize something, and then pass on those cost savings to the consumer. So the gap for non-meat products, non-meat alternatives, definitely should narrow if there's increase in demand, which, again, would drive increase in volume and production.
Let's take a call from Steve in Ridgetown. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just, there was a guy that called in and he had two parts to his question, and the second part didn't get answered. I think it was about China owning meat packing plants in the U.S. So that I just thought maybe he could address it for the second part of his question.
Okay, I missed that. So is China forming meat packing plants in the U.S.?
Boy, Larry, you have a very astute audience. I'm impressed. I was gonna get to that question, and then I just didn't have a chance, so I kind of passed it on. So I appreciate it being brought back up. So, So there are offshore companies that own U.S. meat plants, and the most common or the most well known is WH Group out of China, which owns Shangwei. Or, I'm sorry, not Shangwei, it's what it used to be, but they own Smithfield Foods. WH Group is based out of China. They have legal right of overseeing all aspects of the production for plants that exist in China. For the plants that exist in the U.S., which are the Smithfield Groups, they must relinquish that to U.S. To a U.S.-based group. So, in essence, those companies, right, they don't own livestock. They own the facilities, but those facilities have to operate just as if they were owned by U.S. companies, right? They have to follow the same U.S. rules, regulations, statutes, policies, mandates, all that kind of stuff. So, definitely offshore companies having interest in ownership in U.S. companies, right, suggest that it could be alarming, but, the U.S. has some pretty good policies, some pretty good barriers to ensure that things, they are operating as closely to, U.S.-owned type of businesses.
Yeah. Steve, thanks again. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm just calling in response to the question before about meat and protein. And the guest said that we need meat in our diet for protein. And with the rising world population, we need to have industrial farming and much more meat. And I don't believe this is true. Many athletes now have come out as vegan, and they're strong, and they don't eat meat. And so it would be really neat to have a dietitian come on to talk about this. I'm not a dietitian. I am a vegan. And I just worry about our environment. I worry about the animals and how they're treated. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to mention that if athletes can be vegans, we can too. And we will be healthy.
Pat, thanks for calling. Jeff, comment on that.
Yep, super. Thank you, Pat, for those comments. And I certainly didn't want to, and I surely didn't intend to suggest that everyone has to eat meat to sustain life, because that is certainly not true. I think what I was trying to imply was that by and large, it is. Protein for meat is the most readily available for the body, and it would be really awesome to have a dietitian included in some of these conversations. You can accomplish that for sure without following a non-meat approach. It just takes a little bit. The body isn't as efficient in doing so, and it's ultimately. Not as easy to follow those types of diets for most. So, yeah, great point.
Yeah, great point. Well, as we think about the consumers now, and here we've got these high meat prices, what about some alternative ways? I mean, what about buying, and this is not going to be possible for a lot of people, but from a consumer point of view, if you bought a half a beef or you bought a quarter beef or something like that from a local farmer, you're helping the farmer, and given prices now the way they are, is that a viable alternative for people?
Yeah, great question. I think it is a viable alternative because you're partially viable, right? You're helping the farmer, right? You can get a better cost per pound for product. However, you have to be able to use all the different cuts, right? Some people just like to go out and buy pork chops, and they don't really care about buying, you know, Boston butts or spare ribs or those types of things. The challenge, the big bottleneck right now is the availability of having those animals processed. In Wisconsin, which is not unlike the rest of the U.S., again, driven by demand and not enough workers to do the job, the small processors in the state of Wisconsin are just absolutely swamped. Right, list to have animals harvested for processing. Can range, you know, 2 to 3 years, and so it's a really interesting situation.
Yeah, my dad, rest his soul, worked in one of those local processing plants after we left the farm, and so it was. It's kind of sad to hear that. Well, it's nice to know that these local people are busy, but not that busy.
Yeah.
You wish that there was more. Well, do you expect there's going to be a slowdown in these rising meat prices this year, or is it going to take another year or two?
Well, I'm really horrible at looking at crystal balls, but I am hopeful that as we continue to stabilize as, you know, a nation, right, a people, not, you know, in Wisconsin, across the U.S., and ultimately around the world, right, some of these other situations that are occurring that are also driving some of this mess, if you will, I'm hopeful that on average meat prices will start to stabilize. I think they'll probably continue to go up a little bit, but hopefully not at the same rate as they have in 2020 or 2021. Ultimately, I don't see prices dropping significantly, and unless there's, you know, in the short term, unless there's a mechanism to figure out how to get more people to work, get those, you know, big packers to get, you know, becoming more efficient once again, stabilizing the small processors so that they can, you know, have a 6 or an 8 month wait list rather than a 24 or 36 month wait list. I think it'll be a little bit of a challenge, and probably not expected to see prices start to slow too much or even drop.
You know, my next guest coming up is going to be talking with us about slow cookers and maybe a bit about crock pots too. And I'm wondering, from a consumer point of view, looking at the prices of meats in the supermarket, if those less desirable cuts, which often work well in a slow cooker, might be a choice for them.
I would absolutely agree with that. I might also suggest that, you know, as one of your earlier guests mentioned, you know, maybe meat should be viewed as a treat rather than a necessity. I would absolutely suggest or recommend for people to think about some of the more expensive cuts in that way, right? I mean, to maintain nutrition, we don't need to eat as much meat as we currently do today, right? And the U.S. has a very high per capita consumption of products, partially because we can afford to do so, and partially because this is just how we have always been. But, you know, treating meat as something that is, right, important for the diet, along with other non-meat options, as well as something that is, you know, a special event, right? Like, you know, people don't necessarily need to eat a pound and a half of cheese in one sitting to get the enjoyment out of it. I think can actually help in small bits with the current, you know, supply and demand situation that we started talking about at the beginning of the show.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, it's been a great pleasure. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. There are certainly lots of questions, and you know, we got smart listeners, and pretty good ones. So will you come back and do this again with us sometime?
I would love to, Larry. I enjoyed it very much so, and I really enjoyed interacting with your callers. They're really, really great questions.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Sindelar, professor of and extension meat scientist at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. He works out of the Department of Meat Science and Animal Biologics Discovery. That's the name of the department, Meat Science and Animal Biologics Discovery. And we'll have him back and do it again. And I wanted to bring up the business about perhaps lesser meat products that are in demand, because that might relate well to our next guest as we talk with her about enjoying a home-cooked meal without a lot of the work. That next. I'm Larry Mealer for the Ideas Network.